Joined now, I think we can safely say, by two legends, singer-songwriter Krista Berg and Ross O'Carroll Kelly author Paul Howard. Good morning.
Thank you for not using hunchy posture as a segue.
Listen, I'm not throwing any stones about hunchy posture, I'll tell you that. And Happy New Year. How are you both?
I'm very well. He looks terrific.
That's just Chris, by the way.
Yeah, look at that. Okay, and people might get the gist here. We're going to talk about male friendship today, and it might surprise people to know that the pair of you have been friends for years. Paul, in terms of how the friendship started, so you were a fan of Chris before you became friends. It's every stalker's dream, really.
It really was. I once jumped a barrier that was about a metre and a half high to get Krista Berg's autograph at... it was a Terry Wogan Pro-Am golf tournament and it was in Dunleary Golf Club in 1990, and I saw Chris, and I was a massive Krista Berg fan, and I was an autograph collector as a teenager. So yeah, I leapfrogged this, probably the most athletic thing I've ever done in my life, definitely before and definitely since, and got Krista Berg's autograph on a notepad, and I still have it to this day.
So then the friendship began, I think, as a professional relationship, did it, around Anglo the Musical.
Yeah, just remind us about Anglo the Musical. Which I think I'm safe in saying it's probably the second most disastrous musical ever in Irish musical history. We won't talk about the first. But we had a lot of problems with it. We had a lot of legal problems with it. But the biggest problem was when people were leaving the Borgosh Energy Theatre, they were feeling a bit down.
Yeah. Angry and depressed. That's how you want to send them home.
And we wanted to sort of validate people's anger. And Chris, through our mutual friend Darren Smith, had been an investor in the show. And he called us afterwards and said, look, don't be downhearted. You have a really good show. What you don't have is a closing number. And Chris explained that, you know, no matter what the depressing nature of a musical is, it still should leave you... You should leave the theatre feeling better than you did when you arrived. So Chris said, come up to the house and we'll write a song together. You know, this is something I do every day.
Yeah.
You know? So went up to the house, and it was just before Christmas, and we were sitting in Chris's studio and playing with some ideas. And Diane, Chris's wife, had made these beautiful mince pies. We went down to the kitchen, we were eating the mince pies. And Chris said to me, Paul, what's the last line in the musical? And I said, the last line was, we're effed, but we're here. And Chris disappeared into the next room. And the next thing I heard, the piano going. And he's singing, we're still here, we're still here, we're still here. And then he started to build these verses. And he called me into the room. And I don't know if you remember this, Chris. It was like, we have lived through blah, 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 blah. We have lived through blah, blah, blah. We have lived through blah, 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 blah. And we've lived. And then you said to me, start throwing things that we've lived through at me.
So it was, do you like remember this, Chris?
Emigration.
I do, yes, I do. Very vaguely. But it was a charming moment because I enjoyed the musical very much. But my modus operandi during concerts is sometimes I imagine that I'm standing outside listening to what people are talking about as they leave. And hopefully they're feeling high, literally high in emotion, happy. And even if some of it has been a bit boring in the middle or whatever, leave them with a high note. And I've also written a musical myself called Robin Hood. The same thing. Robin actually dies in it at the very end. But we worked out a system where, in fact, his legacy is then what people are left with. And it's such a big moment at the end, and everybody's tears of joy and happiness. And that's the really important thing. I think that's what we wanted to do with your musical.
But it really worked, Brendan. Like, you know, we brought the musical back to the Olympia. And, you know, we had decent crowds in the Olympia, but the difference was people were leaving feeling, you know, uplifted. And when that chorus went up, the whole cast were on the stage singing, we're still here. And it was a real sort of rallying moment for people. Yeah, people actually left. It was essentially the same musical, but people left feeling completely differently about it than they had the first time.
A bit of showmanship. Chris, you've learned a lot down the years about putting on a show, and I guess often the hard way. Tell me about supporting Supertramp in the early days. And you had a technique, didn't you, for getting the audience eating out of the palm of your hand?
I would say that the first time I went to Montreal would have been 1975, and just just this was a big band like Pink Floyd or somebody, and one guy with a guitar beforehand, and nobody wanted to see him. And the French Canadians are, they use language that I won't use on this radio show, but it's va te faire pire, va be damn. They're shouting at you to get off the stage from the very start because they didn't want to see some young lad with a guitar. I was so annoyed having flown the Atlantic to do this show that I, at the end of my 25 minutes, I walked off the stage and I walked back on again to take an encore. That definitely was not there. And these were tough times. And within 2 years, I was playing the Forum, 15,000 people, three nights in a row. And ever since then, it's been a love affair with the French Canadians. In fact, Canada and the Canadians, I'm back there in March and April to do another tour. And but when you have to fight for your corner, there was another time in Portsmouth. Usually I got introduced, somebody would introduce, and now we haven't. But nobody could be bothered this particular one show in front of Supertramp. So the lights went down, I went onto the stage and I said, ladies and gentlemen, I would like you to put your hands together for a very exciting new young talent with his new album, Far Beyond These Castle Walls. Would you please put your hands together for Chris de Burgh? I walked off the stage, picked up my guitar and walked back on again. And of course, there you got them in the palm of your hand.
Okay, so back to the friendship then. How did it go from being a professional relationship to a friendship, Paul?
Well, I think Chris and Diane invited us to dinner in the house after the musical ended. And that was lovely. And then I sort of fell into this group, actually quite literally fell in some cases.
Yes.
Chris had this.
And out, yeah.
We started a wine club, and Chris, having traveling the world, has amassed this collection of wine. And I don't know whether you got to a certain age, Chris, when you realize I'm going to have to drink all of this.
Well, the best thing was I think I was elected chairman because I had more wine than anybody else. But it was four guys called Paul. We had Paul Byram, the wonderful singer who's just come back from 48, a tour of America. And then we have Paul Farrer, who's an icon, a titan of the insurance world, who also started a wonderful charity of first responders in the name of his grandchild, Penny. Penny, that's right. And then we have Paul McNeave, who is actually everybody's hero. Paul McNeave became the top of a major estate agency in spite of the disabilities of losing his legs at a young age in a terrible accident. But he's also a very gifted writer and a very funny guy. And a wonderful company. And then the fourth Paul. Who's the fourth Paul?
I'm the fourth
Paul. Oh, you're the fourth
Paul.
So you're there purely because your name is Paul.
Because my name is Paul. Yeah, you know? I think Chris has other groups of Johns and Franks and Terrys. Well, it's really very convenient to remember the
names.
We
have a few blow-ins like the helicopter pilot. Lovely.
Oh, that's right.
So there's a helicopter involved.
There was a helicopter involved. So Chris said, come to the house. We're going on a mystery
I'm thinking
tour.
Of what first attracted you to the superstar, Chris de Burgh, and his wine collection and his helicopter. Okay. I'm seeing what's in this friendship. Yeah,
I don't
for you.
Know what's in it for Chris. That's the thing.
And the swimming pool.
But I went to the house. I remember the first time going to the house. He said, "You know, it's a group of us. We can drink this wine, but we're going to go off on a bit of a mystery tour." So I get to the house. I'm handed a glass of champagne at about 11 o'clock in the morning, and Chris said, "Oh, the bus is coming," and we're waiting for the bus. And then I just hear this helicopter in the sky, and it's like, you know, it's like the retreat from Saigon or something, you know. This thing lands. There's a football pitch at the back of Chris's house, and this thing lands, and we get onto this helicopter. But the funniest thing, Chris said to me, I just had a shirt on, and Chris said, you can't just get in a helicopter like that. So you'll need something warmer. So he gave me one of his, it was a sort of kind of plum coloured sweater and a leather jacket.
Yeah, yeah.
And I put these two things on, and as I'm walking towards the helicopter, I catch me and Chris's reflections in the glass of the helicopter, and I realise we just looked like a mini-me version of you. It was like father and son.
Which one was the father?
So the helicopter took us up to Newramore, and we sat there in the restaurant, and we drank this wine. It was amazing. I was looking down at my old school and my old house on the way, you know.
But I have to make one thing. We didn't just go there to drink and be jolly.
That's why I went, Chris.
Oh, yeah. We stopped off to have a bit of culture on the way, like in Rochelstown Castle. We went to Castle Leslie, and there was one other castle we went to.
We went around Stonehenge.
So this is like on a stag party, the way guys always go go-karting before they hit the pub. There has to be an an activity first, Chris, well, before the drinking starts.
It makes us feel a bit better about what we're about to do. And when we were at the Nuremberg Hotel, there was this lovely waiter who was a singer. Remember?
Oh, he used to come up with food. Yeah.
But, you know, nowadays, when the helicopter's no longer with us, it's moved off to Western Canada, we go to restaurants like 1909 in Dorky, excellent restaurant. And there was they allow us to bring us our own wines. And also the China Sichuan, which I don't know if you know, is the best Chinese restaurant in the world, probably. And Kevin Hoy lets us bring our own wines. And there was one occasion, I think Paul was involved in this particular thing, where we started lunch. Oh, sorry, we started with a glass of champagne in the Powers Court Hotel on the terrace there in the sunshine. And then we moved on to the China Sichuan at about 1:30. And during the afternoon, a group of about 20 people came in who were very miserable looking because they'd just been to bury their uncle or somebody. Mm. But we were being very jolly, and Paul Ferrer goes into them and says, look, would you like a couple of songs? So Paul Byram goes in and starts singing, and they like that very much. And I stand on the table and sing Patricia the Stripper. under the influence, I have to tell you. And at the end of the night, we're still there at 10:30. This man, Howard, and a couple of other people went out onto the street to call their wives and partners. Can you come and collect me, please? Where are you? I don't know.
I seem to be in Sandyford Industrial Estate. But that day in particular, and you know, this funeral party, like Chris said, they were, you know, they just buried someone. But the widow was a big Christa Berg fan. And, you know, we're joking about the day and everything, but the joy that Chris in particular brought to that family, I mean, they would never ever forget that day. I think, you know, they were so gratified by.
Can I pick up on that point? Because whenever I meet Paul, it's like two things colliding, in a good way.
Yeah,
because his imagination is so extraordinary, and I think I've got a pretty strong one myself. But he is involved in so many different projects. He's a brilliant man. I think he's very self-deprecating. I think he does not realize just what a genius he is. And look, he's putting his head down. He's going, all shucks.
I'm not having that. Very difficult to listen to.
This guy, he really is outstanding. And I know that his name has gone far and wide, even to other countries like Russia, in Iran, and all sorts of places. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Chris is talking about my one book that was translated into Russian, I think.
Yes.
One of the Rosso Caracelli books. The Orange Mocha Chip Frappuccino. Yours. Thanks for this, Chris. It was translated into Russian. And this man called Alexander Golev used to ring me every Thursday night and ask me to translate various aspects of the books. So he would ring me and say things. It was the kind of the sort of parochial cultural references he didn't get. Like, so he understood the language, but he would say, you know, what is Club 92? You know, what is Gronja Shoiga? What is Avoca Hamweavers? And I would have to explain the significance of these people and these things to him. And the one thing he couldn't get his head around was that somebody who played rugby could be a hero among his peer group. So for the Russian version, they changed it to basketball. And because it wasn't a faithful translation, they lost whatever grant they were getting from the Department of Culture. They lost it because they changed it to basketball. But I saw the cover of the book, and it was, I mean, God knows what he got out of those conversations with me, because the cover of the book was a thatched cottage in the west of Ireland with a rainbow at the back.
Oh, yeah. Beautiful. I have a story about Russia. You may want to go to a break. I'm not quite sure, but can I tell you a little story?
Yeah, of course.
I have been to Russia many times, and I've been to Moscow, St. Petersburg, Nizhny Novgorod, Murmansk to do concerts, because I'm well known in Russia. And I've performed inside the Kremlin on multiple occasions as well. But there's one thing you have to be very careful of with Russians, and this is not a general expression, but it certainly happened to me a few times. Don't believe everything you're told, because I was asked to do...
Really?
Really? Yeah. This is just a special operation. That's okay. My office said that I was going to be met and at the Sherbet, whatever it is, airport, in the VIP lounge, and they wanted to do an interview there. So I get to, to the VIP lounge after the flight. And this lady there with a camera crew says, "Ah, Grisborg, very nice to have you back in Moscow. We can't do this these interviews here. We must do it down in the hotel, in the Ritz-Carlton." So we go down.
If you were doing any other accent in the world right now, I'd be saying, "No, stop, don't do it." But I think we kind of have a free pass on Russia at the moment. Yeah, so go on, yeah.
So we get to the hotel, and the crew are there in the lobby, and the lady says, "Oh, Grisborg, I'm sorry, we can't do this here. It's a problem. We must walk across towards Red Square, and we would do interview over there." Now, I'm actually in Moscow to do a show in what's it called, the Lubyanka Square, you know, very close to the famous dreadful Lubyanka. 50,000 people indeed showed up, and anyway, I go across the square, and there's this thing set up a bit like a Christmas market, you know, with the little huts here and there. And she says, "Now, we are just about to go live across Russia. 1 second." And then this sort of large babushka lady is standing behind the counter. And she says, 1, 3, 2, 1, live. Now, she says, "Grisborg, what is your favorite jam?" I said, "What?" She says, "What is your favorite jam?" I said, "I don't know, strawberry." So she gestures at the lady. She puts her spoon into the strawberry jam and hands it, which I'm eating it on camera. I think, what on earth? I was thinking other things. What else do you like, Grisborg? And I said, "Well, maybe this apple." So anyway, the next day, my translator said, "We think we know what happened here. Putin had a dispute with the European Union about bringing in produce and fruit and vegetables. So he ordered every farmer within 200 kilometers to bring in fruit and vegetables.
And force feed it to Krista Berg.
And force feed it to me." So I'm that big force. And it was just a PR exercise. It was quite extraordinary.
Sort of the Lord Haw Haw of jam.
And they have a great word in Russia called vronya, which is essentially absolute, utter rubbish, but stronger. And it also means that I'm telling you a lie, Brendan, and you know I'm telling you a lie, and both of us don't care because you know that I'm lying to you anyway.
Yeah, okay, I can see why they have a word for that. There's a text here, Brendan. "I feel like Paul has fallen into a South County Dublin parallel universe. I'm sure there were jokes about wine clubs in Ross or Carol Kelly books." This is the thing, Paul, you certainly starting out, you would have had a big chip in your shoulder about people who are, will we use the word posh?
Yeah, people who got on helicopters and went to wine clubs. Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah.
It was just because you weren't doing it. It's okay now.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, if you're excluded from the club, like, yeah. You know, yeah. I mean, but I, you know, my excuse is to satirize it, to send it up. I have to get close to it.
Yes,
you know,
you're in deep cover.
I would know nothing about wine clubs if I wasn't actually.
And is it
myself.
All banter and fun, or do you guys go deep?
I mean, to be honest, like, we do go deep. I mean,
we have very serious comments here. Yeah. And I mean, I would say sort of 60-70% banter. And during COVID,
I love that there's a percentage.
Precise. Oh, yeah, and that's policed as well, Brendan.
I would arrange for everybody to get bottles of wine up front, and then we'd discuss them for about 2 minutes and then get on to the serious and funny stuff. So it's actually a bit of everything, which is a lot of laughter.
He sent her own wine during COVID.
Oh, my God. This box of wine arrived during COVID. And we so the wine club meeting is 3 weeks away. And I've got the box of 6 bottles of wine that Chris very kindly sent. And I'm looking at it. And about a week before, I said to my wife, "God, I've got to drink all those bottles in the next week." So because what I would do is I would drink them and then I would Google the wine and come up with 2 adjectives use, because I don't know anything about wine. I could, if I closed my eyes, I couldn't tell you if it was red or white. Usually, you know, this comes as a surprise to Chris. So I come up with a couple of adjectives, and there'd be a lot of thoughtful chin scratching and everything. But this wine arrived, and I was getting through it. And there was
getting through it. That's what he was doing with your fine wines, Chris. Getting through it.
I remember the last night, Mary said, "What are we having for dinner?" And I said, "I'll go out and get fish and chips from the chipper in Cornell's Court." And I brought it home and I was eating it and I was drinking it with the wine. And as soon as the wine touched my lips, I thought, oh dear. Because I knew it was expensive. So Mary Googled it. I won't say what it cost, but I mean, when I said on the wine at the next wine meeting that it goes very, very well with smoked cod and chips, I was poo-pooed for that. But it was incredibly expensive and wasted on me. I mean, it's giving strawberries to a donkey, but really.
When we get together for our lunches, usually there's a fairly serious beginning. Now, this one is from such and such a place in I want you to imagine the hillside here, and the grape is picked at this time of year and blah, blah, blah. By the time we get into the third bottle, nobody has any interest whatsoever in learning anything at all about the next bottle.
Okay, so you can start serving up the cheap stuff at that stage.
I often do that.
Paul, there's a kind of a crossover then between the League of Gentlemen, I think he called the group, and Chris's family as well. Chris's son, Hubie, comes to lunch sometimes.
He did. He came to lunch once. Chris has an amazing family, by the way. People would know Diane and his kids. I mean, Roseanne obviously is very well known, but Michael and Hubie are just great. There's such a credit to you and Diane, the kids.
Thank you.
But they have a great sense of humour, and they have a great sense of humour about Chris. And there was one lunch we were at in Sandyford, and we were drinking this wine, and it was beautiful. It was really, really nice wine. And Hubie said, it's a great line, he just said, "All this for one song." And you just looked at him and you went, "Oh, but Hubie, what a song."
Actually, I have to explain, Hubie now hasn't been drinking for several years because he's probably had too much of my wine. But it's good fun. The thing about wine, you share it. It's for sharing. Yeah.
Back to the lady in red, 40 years old this year.
She is
that right?
Yeah, she's 40 years old.
I beg your pardon. I mean, they're me calling her it. Yeah.
She's
been good to you.
But even more interesting is the fact that the album Spanish Train and Other Stories came out 50 years ago this year. And I can tell you that Patricia the Stripper must be pushing about 140 right now.
Wow.
So you wouldn't want to be involved in that one.
And she's still on the go if the circumstances are right.
If the circumstances are right.
If the company is appropriate. a grieving widow.
Well, if you were at my my concert in the Bord Gáis earlier this year, which I'm happy to say everything's sold out for the last 3 years or whatever. But anyway, we put Patricia the Stripper on at the end and the place did go mad. And people keep throwing underwear up. Is that you throwing the underwear? Anyway, people throw up underwear. And the funny thing is at the end of the show, the same ladies asked the road crew, "Can I have the underwear back so I can throw it again tomorrow?"
I said to Chris once, "They still throw their underwear at you," and he said, "Yeah, but as you get older, the underwear gets bigger." I saw it in the Bord Gáis. I thought somebody was parachuting onto the stage. Actually,
are you still a fan, Paul?
I am. Yeah, yeah.
The music,
I'm a huge fan. I mean, you
better say that.
I had a teacher at school, Irish teacher, Garadine O'Dwyer was her name, and she brought in. She was a huge fan in the early 80s, and she brought in The Getaway and Spanish Train and lent it to everyone in the class. We all recorded it illegally, probably, Chris. I probably owe you money for that. But those songs...
You owe him a lot more money than that.
Those songs...
I wouldn't start counting.
Spanish Train, Patricia the Stripper, Borderline, which I love. I just love that song. Chris was able to conjure up a whole world in a 4-minute song. Just brilliant stories with characters, and you understood the whole story in 4 minutes. That's what I loved, and that's what I still love about Chris's music.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, like, I can say the same thing about what you write. I have to tell you, you're a genius when you can bring out that, you know, with your Rosa Carol Kelly piece every year. Today, I presume it's in the paper, but your books as well, they are dramatic and interesting and fascinating and very, very funny.
In your gang? My friends are like you at all. I never get this kind of positive affirmation for my work.
I have a lot of friends who keep me grounded, and I really wish they'd stop, so I think that's why.
Yeah.
That's
why. Look, if you have enough groundedness, like, you need to get in the helicopter now and again and drink the fine wine.
He's slipping me a 50 euro note. Keep it to yourself.
It's in Russian.
So, I suppose a lot of people, especially men, are not great at keeping up their friendships. Friendship, obviously, very important to both of you. What's the secret, Chris, to keeping your friendships watered and alive?
I think friendships are like a circle. The inner one is the family, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then the next circle is probably 2 or 3 close friends with whom you can share anything. And beyond that, you have a larger circle of more... friend, acquaintances, people you'd like to spend a lot of time with. For example, I go on tour a lot, and I have at least five crew in my band, five crew in my touring bunch of people who've been with me for 20 years and more. And when we go out on tour, it's like real friendship all the time. But I know
you can 100% be yourself with these
absolutely,
guys.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then you go. But Paul, he's slipping me another 50 euro. he's in the inner circle. But I think the friendship. There's a lot going on now with the social media as well, because there's a lot of superficial friendships going on. But the other side of it is you can keep in touch with people you may not have been able to keep in touch with for various other reasons down the years. So I think it's really important to be able to do that. But physically, actually getting together is the key thing to actually be in the same room with someone.
Okay, and to make time and make the effort for that, Paul. Yeah, friendship's very important to you.
Really
as well,
important to me. And I, you know, I realized that a lot during COVID as well, you know, when I was cut off from my friends and talking to them virtually, you know, talking to them through TV screens, computer screens. So since COVID, you know, when I'm writing, I go into my own little world, and I used to put the phone out of the room or put it on silent so I wouldn't be bothered by texts or messages like that while I was working. And I've stopped doing that now. I have it there on the table. So if somebody texts me and I'm writing something, I'll stop and reply to
text. Okay, yeah, because that's more important.
It is more important, and it took me a long, long time to realise it was more important.
What are you writing, by the way?
I've been working on a lot of television stuff the last year or two. I worked on a show called Sisters, which is going to be on RTE at the end of January. I'm really excited about that. I worked on the new series of The Young Offenders as well. I've been doing quite a since I finished writing the Ross O'Carroll Kelly books, I've transitioned a bit into TV writing, and I'm really enjoying
that. Very successfully too.
And Chris, you're off on tour again, are you?
Yes, I'm starting in Canada in March, April, and then in Europe during the summer. Then I will go into another musical project. But last time I was on here, you were kind enough to let me sing a little melody that was been in my head for a long time. And your readers, your listeners, all contact me to tell me what the thing was, which was great. It was, what was it called? The day thou gavest, Lord. Because I couldn't put words to it. However, if you allow me to sing another one, this is for your listeners. Can they tell me what this is from? The words actually are familiar, but can they tell me what the melody is and where it comes from? The days of our age are 80 years and 10, and though men be so strong that they come to 80 years, yet is their strength then, but labour and sorrow so soon passeth it away, and we are gone.
Okay, have at it, people. It's gone out there, and look, loads of people texting in with loads of memories of Chris, and loads of love for Paul as well. So look, ye love each other, everybody loves ye. Paul Howard and Chris de Burgh, thank you so much. I know it sounded like that was a kind of a Shaggy Dog story going around the place, but it was a really actually profound illustration of male friendship that we don't see a lot. Chris, I'm going to finish up with, as you said, Spanish Train is 50 years old.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
So I'm going to play a bit of the live version from Dublin. Just to put in context, the beast that is Chris de Burgh and the audiences you play to and everything. Just set this up for us. This was in the RDS, wasn't it?
We did a series of 12 shows in the RDS, and the best audiences in the world without any doubt, and they could really sing. I mean, I'm not just saying that because I'm speaking to Irish people right now, but without a doubt, they are fantastic.
Okay.
So that when the song began, as you might hear, the reaction is astonishing.
It's astonishing. So here is Chris de Burgh and the audience in the RDS with the 50-year-old Spanish Train. Paul Howard and Chris de Burgh, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. And now, my friends, come away with me on a journey into the unknown. Perhaps to hell itself. There's a Spanish train that runs between. Guadalquivir and Old Seville. At dead of night, the whistle blows and people hear. She's running still. And then they hush their children back to sleep. Lock their doors upstairs, they creep. For it is said that the souls of the dead fill that train. 10,000 deep.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.